Dear listeners, welcome to Faces of Digital Health, a podcast about digital health and how healthcare systems around the world adopt technology, with me, Tiasza Zeitz. In the last few years, we've witnessed a whirlwind of development in the world of digital therapeutics. We saw FDA approval sparking optimism for the industry. We saw the establishment of regulatory frameworks in countries like Germany, France, and Belgium. However, in 2023, the industry faced a stark reality check marked by the fall of some of the key players and healthcare systems' hesitancy towards embracing and financing these innovations. This turbulence has reshaped strategies and raised critical questions about the future of digital therapeutics. So in this episode with Andy Molnar, CEO of the DTX Alliance, you will hear more about the business models companies are testing to try to get their businesses up and running, insights Andy has about the DTX reimbursement and approaches globally, why he's still optimistic about digital therapeutics, and more. Enjoy the show, and if you haven't yet, make sure to check out our newsletter, which you can find at fodh.substack.com. That's fodh.substack.com. Now let's dive in. Andy, hi, and thank you so much for joining this discussion where we are going to try to give the audience and the listeners a little bit of a background on where digital therapeutics are at the moment. There's a lot that has been happening in the last few years. I would even describe the whole situation as a huge roller coaster. We went from thinking if digital health apps are just hype to actually feel it maturing to the level of bringing to the patients solutions that are clinically validated, that have a very well proven clinical impact on patient outcomes. We saw the FDA support these solutions. We saw frameworks for regulation to support reimbursement of these solutions, especially in Europe. And yet many companies are going bankrupt. There's various challenges that are arising. So this is what I want to talk about today. And I actually want to start with a bit of a journey down the memory lane. And I want to ask you, how do you remember DTX? When did you first hear about them? When did you first start thinking about them? And how would you describe the last, let's say, 5 years in the industry?
Sure. I heard about DTX when I was working at Sunovion Pharmaceuticals. Some of the people in the business development group that were looking at innovative technologies heard about Pear Therapeutics. And that was around the time that Pear started to get a lot of attention. And one of my close colleagues went over there and a couple months later said, "We have another position. Are you interested?" And he started going into all the details, all the pros and cons, and these are apps that are clinically validated. And I just said, "I'm in." And he said, "Do you have any more questions?" I said, "No, this is clearly going to be a major part of health, of the future of healthcare, and I want to be part of it." And so that was the start for me. And I feel like in digital therapeutics, you do get a lot of people that see the future and see the potential and get really excited about it. And I've been doing this now since 2018. And it sometimes you go through the tough times, but you know that in the long term, that there is a major place for digital within healthcare. And so you have to look at these hard times and say, we know we're going to come out of it. And really, as part of this, I will bring up the Gartner hype cycle, because that kind of explains all new technologies. And we are in the trough of disillusionment right now. And I got into this when we were on the upswing of everybody seeing the potential. The investment was huge. And we just thought, this is going to be amazing. But healthcare change does not come without challenges. And with that, we started to see, okay, we're not seeing the revenues fast enough. So venture capital is getting frustrated. We're not seeing coverage fast enough. There's not enough real world evidence. So payers are saying, we want to wait and see until we get there. And so we're going through this natural cycle. Anyway, through these ups and downs, I was at Pear Therapeutics. I went to Cognoa to look at software as a medical device to diagnose children with autism. I was incredibly passionate about that. And then that was in 2019. And then I realized that I was doing things like, how do you e-prescribe apps? What's the workflow for getting these products from a pharmacist into the hands of patients? What does reimbursement look like? What types of things have to happen with Medicare and Medicaid from a policy perspective and a government affairs perspective? And so I realized that really my place was in the association. And so that's how I ended up here. And I've been at the Digital Therapeutics Alliance just fighting for the future of the industry for the last 3 years. Or I shouldn't say fighting. I think it's natural. It's more like trying to ensure that the industry is guided in a way that is best for the patients.
Mm. And what kind of differences do you see among markets? As the CEO of DTX Alliance, you have a bit of a global overview. And I know that some people from the US would say that there's been a bit of a, not exactly disillusionment, but perhaps lack of enthusiasm that's currently present in the industry. If we look at Europe, there's at least three countries that have very clear frameworks, France, Belgium, and Germany. But still, the actual results, at least at the moment, are a bit disappointing. There's a lot of struggles with actually getting providers convinced that this needs to be prescribed to patients. So what do you see in the US and, say, the APAC region? How would you, if you tried to look at the DTX world globally, where do you see the most potential, or do challenges differ in different markets?
Certainly, a lot to unpack there. But what I will say is, what I'll start with is, as humans, there's sort of two sides, and we're always fighting against each other. One is we want innovation, and the other side is we have to keep that innovation completely checked. And you do need both, but it really reminds me of like continuous glucose monitors, right? The first one came out in 1999. The initial feedback was, these are way more expensive than test strips. Test strips cost pennies. We don't think there's any clinical value in addition to what people are already doing. So payers really looked at the health economics value. They said, it's not there. And they pushed back. But you always knew that CGM was the right next step. But there was all this pressure saying, nah, too expensive, not going to add any value, et cetera, et cetera. Remote patient monitoring, remote therapeutic monitoring are in that same place right now. The proof of demonstrating the additional value of being able to monitor a patient at home, there's still a lot of work to be done, but there's really no question in people's minds that there's something there that's really important. And with CGMs, now there's a lot of coverage. There's still people that don't have CGMs. And they're connecting to additional tools because the use cases of a CGM are so big. And everybody knew that, but it's been 20 years to really take a stronghold. And most people are still not using CGMs. When you look at that pressure to stop innovation, it's frustrating. But it's disappointing. We could really get there so much faster if we looked at something and said, we know how to do this, let's put our money in evidence generation, in real world evidence generation, not secondary evidence or secondary analysis, really primary evidence generation, and get to a point where we can prove that these really obvious tools work. And so with that, we see the pressure in the US from Medicare and Medicaid to not pay for these things. Medicare costs $920 billion, or give or take, a year, and that's been going up steadily since the 1970s. So something that looks like it's additive in cost, there's going to be pressure not to cover it. On the flip side, in Medicare and Medicaid, you have populations that don't have access to these types of tools. And so what's happening is, like usual, the wealthy get access to tools that they need, and the poor have to wait. And that's not what digital therapeutics exists for. So regardless, we're fighting that same battle right now that all of healthcare innovation has gone through over the years. But what we see is Germany, great example, right? They have the DiGA program. They have many products that are covered. And we're starting to see some stability in that program. Okay, there's always going to be positives and negatives in any government program that comes out. It's never going to be perfect from the start, but we're really starting to see companies like Hello Better that has six products on the DIGA really demonstrate uptake in the patient population in Germany and physician adoption. And it's happening because the products are available. And that's really not the case in some other developing countries and even in the United States. And so with that, Germany is a really clear example. France is right behind them. But the difference is that because France modeled PECON after DIGA, a lot of the companies know what to expect and they know how to repeat what they've already done. And so I suspect that now that I think in a couple of weeks, we're going to see an update on PECON coverage and what initial products they're going to have. We're going to see that move a lot faster. In South Korea, we saw coverage of AMED, which is an insomnia product. I talked to the Korean FDA in December of last year. I asked them if there was anything we can do to help, and they laughed and they said, "We're actually helping you guys." And just recently, some people from the FDA actually went over to South Korea to talk to them about they're looking at digital therapeutics. And so they're ready to go. What they said to me was, "We really wanted to look at South Korean companies first and figure this out. Now we're ready for people to come to South Korea from other countries and launch their digital therapeutics here." So I think we're going to see a very quick uptake in countries like South Korea. And then obviously Japan and Singapore are also moving things forward.
Yeah, you reminded me when you were talking about this, I guess, disappointment that I'm talking about at the moment, like this feeling that we're not really getting anywhere with the digital therapeutics, you kind of reminded me of the uptake of patient portals on national levels, which also usually take quite a few years, and countries do the mistake of trying to get people in the opt-in models, which doesn't work. So then they turn that into opt-out. And gradually over the years, you actually have the penetration of providers pushing the data in the national portal. So from that perspective, I guess I can share your potential hope that this is still going to develop nicely. So what approaches do you see at the DTX Alliance among your members in terms of the business models? Because many companies filed for bankruptcy, gave up because it just didn't work fast enough. And so companies need to get very creative in terms of how to survive. What do you see in that sense?
Yes, obviously Achille went over the over-the-counter approach, which I like to think makes a lot of sense for them. A lot of other companies are offering their products through employers, through their HR systems, much like you would have other services like weight loss, Noom, and things like that. But we're also seeing a lot of partnerships with pharma, and that allows for very unique applications of digital therapeutics. That and PDERS with the FDA, which is products that are used alongside drugs, because you can see this potential clinical value of having these products alongside other therapies, alongside remote patient monitoring, alongside remote therapeutic monitoring. And that leads to a different value prop than simply, this is a point solution that is a prescription. And what I also want to point out is that model, the pair model that didn't work, it is not a wrong model. In many cases, they were just too early, and Medicare isn't ready for it yet. And Medicare, unfortunately, drives a lot of reimbursement from commercial payers. So I don't actually want to discount that model yet, but I think because there's still so many barriers, people have moved away from it. And that's actually the prescription model is what drives DIGA in Germany and is showing a lot of success. So with that, you have to think about every different way that you would take medicine, every different way that you would interact with a provider, and think that all of those models are open and exist, right? And I think it's hard because the categorization of digital therapeutics is already complex. And people would like to say, okay, this is a DTX and this is how I get it. But that's not true. Sometimes you're going to get a digital therapeutic and it's going to be a remote therapeutic monitoring connection to your provider as the first step. And then it's going to start providing interventions. You could get cognitive behavioral therapy delivered through your employer based on a product like Sleepio. right? And then you could have over-the-counter potential, which are still obviously regulated and or FDA regulated in the United States. And I think that all of these are great models, depending on the therapeutic category, depending on the patient population, and depending on the oversight that you need from providers.
What are some of the key discussions that you currently have inside the DTX Alliance? Where do you want to focus your efforts most to have the greatest impact on the industry? So what are the priorities for the industry to actually get to easier reimbursement, better results, and lack of, disappointment again? Because, you know, it's like very frustrating for patients also to know that there's potentially solutions there that could be useful, but are unavailable or just go off the market because, yeah, the actual business models don't work.
Yeah, absolutely. Our number one focus for this year is reimbursement. And then under that is education. There's still a lot to be done with awareness. And you talk about that. You talked about that with like patient uptake, right? There's a big difference between somebody that doesn't use their phone for any healthcare, right? And those that use Noom and use Calm and use these very decent mobile health apps, where if you said to that person, hey, I'm going to prescribe you a product that's on your phone to help you manage your diabetes, they would be open to it. And then there's another group that would say, I don't understand why you're doing this because it's still so new. On the reimbursement side, It's focus on policy, it's focus on state level reimbursement, and it's focused on commercial payers. So there's still a lot of work that needs to be done with CPT coding so that providers can get paid for the use of these products. If you imagine when PAIR started, they said, hey, use this new technology, give this to your patients, it's going to show them better outcomes. You're going to have to help them understand this technology, but also on top of that, you're not going to get paid. That is not like an easy way for doctors to say, I'm going to try something new. Okay. We have to work on that. We have to work on the physician fee schedule and ensuring that there's coverage through for software. We still have to work on our prescription digital therapeutics bill. We're revamping that now. After a lot of conversations last year in Congress, the bill needs to be more specific on pricing so that the government can understand what this will cost Medicare. And so we're going to do a lot of work there, and we're doing a lot in Medicaid as well. So that involves a federal Medicaid connection, working on the ideas that we put in our legislation from 2022, and also working on the state level, because we've seen states cover digital therapeutics. They can already. They don't need federal CMS to approve that, but we need some standardization there. They need to understand what it means to cover digital therapeutics, what the outcomes are going to look like, and what their interaction with managed Medicaid plans will be in the federal government. So those two areas are really are how we feel we're going to drive the industry forward best this year and for the long term.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps just one very brief comment. What do you expect in terms of the reimbursement fees? Because in Europe, we see two approaches. So Germany took the approach of companies proposing the prices, which were adjusted after a year when the deals were approved and were more or less slashed a lot by the insurance companies that kind of assessed what they're willing to pay. And France went a step further in the sense that basically they determined in advance what the price ranges might be so that innovators can at least have a bit of a feeling what they can expect. What are your expectations in terms of how the market is going to be regulated in the pricing sense, maybe in the US, where you work most of the time?
Yeah, so this is the weighing the pros and cons of having a national healthcare system like many countries have in Europe versus not. And I love to see is value-based contracting. We're seeing different companies do that. It's an administrative burden, but that's where your price is really connected to the value that you're bringing each patient. And so I would love a world where we see a lot more value-based contracting, and that's across drugs, medical device, digital therapeutics, services. Because that's where you would truly see savings, and you'd only be paying for what's impactful. And we're in this world of precision medicine where I think we need to be thinking of people as individuals and not as just part of a group. So there is that, but there's also on the drug side, there's mandatory rebates. So we see that on the formulary side. So with organizations like Express Scripts and CVS and Optum, you also see rebate structures where you negotiate a price directly with these commercial entities. But as far as Medicare is concerned, from a government perspective, it still looks like it's going to be more fee-for-service and an actual price associated with each product. In many ways, that, in my mind, that makes it harder, because I'd like to see it be associated more with the value that you're providing each patient.
You've been listening to Faces of Digital Health, a proud member of the Health Podcast Network. If you enjoyed the show, do leave a rating or a review wherever you get your podcast, subscribe to the show, or follow us on LinkedIn. Additionally, check out our newsletter. You can find it at fodh.substack.com. That's fodh.substack.com. Stay tuned.